The show of the African People's Solidarity Committee. We broadcast here on Uhuru Radio every Sunday at 4 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. We want to thank the African People's Socialist Party for giving us this hour every Sunday. We discuss issues relating to the question of solidarity with the struggle for the liberation of Africa led by the party and the Uhuru movement. The African People's Solidarity Committee is the organization formed by and led by the African People's Socialist Party. APSC is for North Americans or Europeans, white people, who recognize that this social system is built on the enslavement of African people, on the genocide against the indigenous peoples of this land, and on the colonial domination of the majority of peoples on earth. It is this reality that gives us our opportunities, prosperity, our experience of democracy at the expense of African peoples and so many other peoples on the planet. This show explains a principled relationship that we North Americans can have to African people struggling for their liberation and, by extension, the peoples of the world. This show is about turning loose our whiteness and finding our genuine interest in building peace on the planet through real solidarity with the right of African people to control over Africa and all its resources. What we're going to do today, we wanted to air some presentations that were made in February of this year, some of which we have aired portions of on past programs, but we wanted to go back to that because the All Diamonds Are Blood Diamonds campaign is continuing to build and be of great significance in around the country in exposing the question of the denial of control over African resources to African people, exposing the U.S. and Western exploitation and theft of African resources, and supporting the struggle for those resources to be put back into the hands of African people. So what we're going to air today are two presentations that were made on February 5th of this year at the Church of the Village in New York City, at an event called All Diamonds Are Blood Diamonds. The first presentation that we're going to air is from Diop Olugbala, a leader in the African People's Socialist Party, incredible speaker. We joined his presentation about halfway through, where he's talking about the significance of the movement of the 60s, of the African liberation movement of the 60s, and talking about the diamond question and the role and responsibility of white people. So this is a really powerful presentation. We know you'll get a lot out of it. So here we have Diop Olugbala.
And the struggle of African people reached an unprecedented height during the 1960s. We refer to it as the Black Power Revolution of the 1960s, where the masses of African people began to consolidate a political philosophy that was friendly to our interests. You know what is Black Power? Where we made the demand not for the right to sit next to white folks on the toilet, or the right to integrate into their schools and the rest of it, but the right for African people to have control over our lives. And in this country here, it may have shown itself as a struggle for community control. Malcolm used to talk about community control. The Panthers was organizing, the Black Panther Party organized freedom programs that placed the power in the hands of the people to feed ourselves, to educate ourselves, to get the police out of the community. These were all struggles that emerged during the 1960s, and they were all guided by an understanding of our struggle, our real struggle being for one, for power in our own hands, as opposed to the will or the struggle to integrate into the same system that has been oppressing our people for the last 400 years. And that's all very important to understand, and this is what has helped to shape the philosophy of the Uhuru movement. And I think that it's also important to say that the movement of the 1960s was one where the masses of African people had conscious participation, where we were on the streets all throughout this country and around the world, you know, and truly getting organized. Time magazine ran a random survey during that period asking African people if they believed that or they saw themselves as revolutionaries, and over 80% of the Africans that responded said, yes, I see myself as a revolutionary. This was the political sentiment on the ground in the African community at that time. And not only was it a movement amongst African people, but it was a movement that undermined white power's ability to rule in the same old way. Because we had been able to defeat the U.S. government and white power as a whole on a political and ideological level. Through the work that the Panthers was doing, we were able to expose the U.S. government as not as a democratic government or a government that has the interests of African people in mind, but a government that is actually hostile to the interests of African people. The Panthers organized a program to test Africans for sickle cell anemia, a very simple process that anybody can do, especially a government that has all these resources. But the Panthers chose that particular campaign precisely because it was so easy to do, to expose the real contradiction that existed between us and the U.S. government. Something so simple as the sickle cell anemia test. But the government never did that, perform those tests for African people, because African people were the only ones that got sickle cell anemia. And so through work like that, the Panthers and our movement as a whole was able to expose the real contradiction that existed between the state and African people. And this made the U.S. government look bad on an international level. It defeated the U.S. government politically, and it opened up all types of possibilities for other struggles outside of the African liberation movement. The fact is that the U.S. government, the white power, could not rule in the same old way. That's why you had the emergence of all other types of struggles, whether it be women's liberation or the gay rights or even the white left and the struggle for, you know, more rights for the workers. All of those concessions made for the general population of the white community were won on the back of the African liberation struggle. Because the oppression of African people is what provides the pedestal upon which the entire U.S. government and white power as a social system rests. That's right. If you don't have the oppression of Africans, then the entire system comes crumbling down. That's right. And every single philosophical and ideological component of the system becomes vulnerable when you get to the true heart of the contradiction, which is the oppression of African people and the theft of all of our resources that feed it. And so white power was unable to rule in the same old way. And there were several aspects of its response, the white ruling class's response to this attack. But one I want to really concentrate on is neocolonialism, which is white power in blackface. And as we said earlier, traditionally in the African community, we understood the real contradiction existing between African people and the white man on a real general abstract kind of level. Because all throughout our history, we saw Africans, we all were under colonial domination. In Africa, we were all getting kidnapped. We were all slaves and the rest of it, right? And so for a very long time, we had not been able to recognize class contradictions inside the African community, or even inside the so-called African struggle for rights and freedom. But during the 1960s, we were able to deepen our understanding of class and how it relates to our struggle to be free. Because the fact is that white power can't rule African people, can't control African people without using a sector of the African community to work for it. Right, to use this sector of the community to represent white power in its own interests against the masses of African people. And the reality is that even to this very day, as an African, if you want any real type of access to resources, if you want to live a wealthy lifestyle, and if you want to have some type of what they would refer to as political power in this system, then you have to unite with the agenda of white power. You have to unite with white power against your own people. And this is something that we know, understand as neo-colonialism, white power and blackface. It's very important not only for Africans to understand, but for white people to understand, because what they love to do is say, well, look, the president of South Africa is black, you know, or the president of Jamaica is black, you know. And so they say, essentially, you do it to yourselves. And in fact, they use the worsened conditions in Africa and around the world as a justification for colonialism. That's right. They're saying that Oh, damn, it was better off when the white man was in charge of y'all. Look at what you're doing to yourself. But the reality is that Nelson Mandela worked under the leadership of white power. He was put into power by white power. His campaign manager was the same campaign manager that ran Bill Clinton's campaign. Right? And Nelson Mandela, even though I know, you know, some of y'all are probably, you know, you're progressive minded, so you was like Free Mandela and all that. But the reality is that even while Mandela was in jail, and even before that, when he was, you know, fighting on behalf of the ANC, the ANC's position had always been that the land belonged to both white people and African people. In the face of 400 years of foreign white domination, we just heard Penny's historical presentation on the conditions in Southern Africa, and Nelson Mandela and the ANC talking about the land belongs to white people and African people. That was the ANC's position. But in the 60s, when they was talking that in the streets, that was even the white power didn't want to hear that. You know what I'm saying? Because they said the land belonged to white people only. So during that period, they had to lock up Mandela. But when during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, when we start tearing shit up, now the U.S. government and white power want to let Mandela out so they can carry out its own neo-colonial strategy, because they know they can't contain the African youth that's marching and running in the streets of Soweto and Johannesburg for freedom. So they resorted to a neo-colonial strategy that shows the world that, look, it's not white people that's doing this, it's African people doing it to themselves. And if you go to South Africa today, you find the conditions facing African people to be even worse since Mandela, since the ANC came into power. You know, and that's under neo-colonialism. That is the significance of the neo-colonial strategy. Now, we just came from this demonstration where, and I don't know all the players of the game, and I want to do more research because I want to know who these people are. But I understand that they are using African people to, you know, be like spokespeople on behalf of the diamond industry, to legitimize the diamond industry. And we heard what was said, you know, about the whole the background of the basis of this campaign against blood diamonds, to essentially a campaign to prevent any type of trade of diamonds that operate independent of white power. You know, that's all the whole blood diamond campaign is all about. And so they put up African figureheads to speak on behalf of these of white power, basically, to legitimize the trade, the theft of our diamonds. And we have to be aware of this, because the struggle is not essentially one against racism, or one for integration and for Africans and white people to live side by side holding hands. But it's a struggle to bring the resources that rightfully belong to the masses of African workers and poor peasants back into our possession. And it got nothing to do with what some Negro who got a perm on, or you know, talks like the president of the U.S. has to say. It got nothing to do with it. I don't care if he's blacker than my jacket, or if he's lighter than the light. I don't care. If he is representing an agenda that attacks this fundamental demand we are making, then he got to go. But and that's white power. It works. And we have to be able to expose that. Everybody in this room has to be able to sum that up. Because this whole thing about racism has been a serious contradiction, an ideological assault, really, on the African liberation struggle. Since the 60s, and as we said, during the 60s, we were in a situation where we were able to define what the struggle for African liberation needed to look like. We said that African liberation is about power in the hands of African people. It got nothing to do with the ideas that are inside white people's head. We can give a damn about how white people feel about us as long as we control our lives and our resources. That's all that matters. That's what the Panthers, Malcolm, and Jomo, and the rest of them were able to articulate. And the people could get down with that, because, I mean, goddamn, we integrated, but we're still getting our ass kicked by the police, right? We're still unemployed. We're still living in the worst of conditions. So what has integration, what has the struggle against racism really accomplished for the masses of African people if we don't have no power? And really, a struggle against racism and a struggle for integration is like going backwards. Because if I understand it correctly, the problem began when we came in contact with white people. Right? Oh, it's not as though we were worse off before white power's attack on Africa. The situation worsened with this attack on Africa, with the contact. And I think that's all important for us to understand. And but one thing I want to say right now is that we are in a crucial period of our struggle as African people, and especially as African people. And in our view, the question of African liberation is a key question around the struggle against imperialism and the struggle against capitalism, because more than 80%, I believe, of all of the resources that are in the U.S. or North American and European economies come from Africa. 80%. That's a tremendous amount of resources. And essentially, Africa is the host of this parasite that is white power. And if we can resolve this contradiction around African liberation, then we can strike a serious blow against imperialism.
That was Diop Olugbala speaking on February 5th of this year at the Church of the Village in New York City at an event called All Diamonds Are Blood Diamonds. Next, we are going to hear the presentation made at that same event, Church of the Village, February 5th, 2007, at the All Diamonds Are Blood Diamonds event by African People's Solidarity Committee Chairwoman Penny Hess.
I just want to say that, yes, all diamonds are blood diamonds, and that this is a question, though, that has a context. It has a context that is much bigger than just one issue. And if something happened today to make the diamond situation okay, we wouldn't stop working, because it's just one little part of a whole world situation that we are a part of, and that people around the world are a part of, and that African people are struggling around today. So, you know, I want to begin by saying that I do represent the African People's Solidarity Committee, and that is an organization that was formed by the African People's Socialist Party that leads the Uhuru movement. Uhuru means freedom. That is the word of Swahili. It's a Swahili word that means freedom, that was important in the struggle in Kenya in the 1950s for liberation and the liberation struggle there. And, you know, it's something that has been carried over in so that it now embraces the struggle of African people for liberation all around the world. And I think that it's really important. And it's important to say, first of all, that the African People's Socialist Party, the Uhuru movement, believes and understands that African people all around the world are one people, that we're not talking about African Americans, quote unquote, inside this country. We're not talking about Jamaicans or our people in Haiti or, you know, our Ghana or, you know, South Africans. We're talking about that African people have one shared experience. African people did not come here as immigrants. African people were brought here as a commodity that was essential to building the economy of this country and of Europe and building the capitalist system itself. And so, and we can look at, you know, if we want to look at the truth, we can say that African people in Brooklyn and Queens and Harlem are not citizens of the United States.
Right.
I mean, that's really obvious. It's obvious to any of us that want to look at reality as it really is, that we as the white community have a completely different relationship to the world, to our lives, than African people, indigenous people, Mexican people inside this country. And we have a colony here just as clear as if it were South Africa, if it were Azania, if it were any other part of the world where colonialism is very clear. There's two Americas. And that's why the Uhuru movement, which works for the liberation of African people everywhere, formed the African People's Solidarity Committee. Our job is to go into the white community, to speak to other white people just like ourselves, and to open up ourselves, our families, our friends, our communities to the reality that this country, this world, capitalism itself, was built on slavery. It was built on the genocide of the indigenous people and the theft of their land. And it gives us a pedestal on which we all sit, right, at the expense of African people and the peoples on the planet Earth. So, you know, what we're talking about tonight is not just getting justice around the question of diamonds, but we're talking about changing the world.
That's right.
And when we look at the world as it is today, we see this capitalism, this imperialism in a serious crisis. We see, you know, the Bush, and we see the contradictions in Iraq, and we see that the U.S. can't win in Iraq. We see the people struggling. We see Venezuela. We see Chavez standing up against U.S. imperialism, organizing the people, basically turning it into a socialist state that is happening right now in Venezuela, organizing most of Latin America, working with peoples around the world to use the money from the oil instead of it going to an elite sector of, you know, the wealthy of Venezuela, going to the people. You know, so this creates a crisis for this system and this government. And we see the struggle in Palestine and Lebanon, and the diamonds are in the context of that. You know, it's so, if we look at the reality, we can say that in Congo right now, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, as it's called, there is a mineral called coltan. And coltan is essential for our cell phones and our computers. And in the past 5 years, proxy wars, which are in some cases African people fighting them in the interest of the Western powers to maintain control of those resources, have these wars have been going on against the people of Congo, and 5 million Africans have been killed in that, but nobody talks about it.
Right.
You know, there's no demonstrations, no blood for coltan. But we can say the reality is that all computers are blood computers.
That's right.
And all cell phones are blood cell phones.
Right.
And we can look at oil, and we can see what's happening in Iraq, and we can say, well, oil is blood oil. And we can look at Nigeria.
That's right. Yes.
Where African people are saying, we're getting, you know, the people are starving in the Niger Delta, where Shell is taking out 500,000 barrels of oil a week, and the people are starving to death. And they're struggling against that. And they're saying, if we don't get the oil, nobody gets the oil. Nobody gets it. And this is a struggle everywhere, because we can say that all oil is blood oil. I just saw a movie online, a documentary about Gap in Indonesia, where the people work for $1 a day to make our jeans, so we can get them for, you know, on sale, the sale rack at Gap for $9 or something, that we get there. And the people have no electricity, no running water, the same thing. So we can say all our jeans are blood jeans.
Right.
And
right.
And we know about Nike, so we can say all our running shoes are blood running
right.
shoes.
Right.
There's really nothing that is not, that is,
right.
that, you know, that is
that's
clean,
right.
that is good.
Right.
Everything
right.
is dripping right. in the blood of the peoples on the planet
that's
Earth.
Right.
And that's, but who has the benefit of it? You know, that goes to us.
Yeah.
So I think that what we have to say is we have to look at, how did this get started? How did this happen? And the reality is, in the Middle Ages, Europe was poor, Africa was wealthy, Africa was prosperous, the indigenous people had incredible civilizations. As much as we're told, you know, we aren't told that in our history books, but if in school, but if we really study it, we can see that in the Middle Ages, we call it the Dark Ages, right?
Right.
You know, well, we call it the White Ages, because that's just dealing with that. But actually, the rest of the world was doing great. China was unified, the Mongol civilization in Asia, Persia, you know, Iraq, India, Timbuktu, Mali, Songhai, and the Aztecs, the Mayans, there were incredible civilizations all around the world, but we learn in this Eurocentric thing that it was, the, you know, the world was, it was desperate, people were impoverished. Well, that was true in Europe, but that wasn't true in the rest of the world. So Europe was hit by the plague. It killed maybe 30 to 50% of Europe's population in the 1300s and 1400s. And what was the response of Europe? The response of Europe was to begin an assault on Africa, on the Americas, on Asia, to save themselves and bring resources into Europe for the first time. And, you know, and it's not like there wasn't trade before. There was world trade. There were trade routes that went from Mali to Northern Africa, throughout the Middle East, to through India, China, and even to the Americas. There, you know, people sailed to the Americas from Africa. There is evidence of that. The Olmec heads, the Olmec civilization, which was clearly African. But we aren't taught that, of course. But in the Middle Ages, there was poverty in Europe, and so there was oppression in Europe. The majority of people were serfs, were basically tied to the land with no freedom, no democratic rights. Workers didn't have unions. They didn't own a house or anything like that. So Europe began an assault on Africa, and it started in the 1400s in Portugal. Henry the Navigator sent out ships to go to West Africa to begin to try to capture the gold and the spices and the silk and all of the West Africa trade, to begin to control that. But actually what they began to do was begin to enslave African people and begin to start forming a commodity of human beings themselves. And this was the birth of the capitalist system. There's no other way. There's no other way that it happened. How could impoverished Europe suddenly become wealthy and powerful when it had nothing? It happened because by 1500, by the year 1500, Europe had already taken out of Africa 700 tons of gold going into Portugal and Spain, which basically at that time were the same thing. This was the beginning of wealth, money, a monetary system going into Europe. It was the birth of capitalism. Along with that was sending Columbus to the Americas, to the Caribbean, to North America and South America, where, again, gold, silver, resources were taken out and brought to Europe at the expense of the indigenous people, at the genocide of hundreds of thousands, really hundreds of millions of indigenous people on this hemisphere. So this is what our system is built on. It's built on slavery. It's built on genocide. It's built on colonialism around the world. And that we have in this country wave after wave of European immigrants that came here. But in every instance, united with the system and the ability to step on the backs of African people to walk up the ladder of success for ourselves. And I want to say that as a background for what we're talking about, because the question of diamonds, you know, I just want to say one other thing about that, because there is no part of the U.S. economy, no part of it, that was not tied to the enslavement of African people and the genocide of the indigenous people. There wasn't like a little, it's like they say there was clean diamonds today. There's no clean diamonds today. There's no clean part of the economy. So we can't say, you know, I hear people on WBAI or KPFA radio and they're saying, well, you know, it's just that America has been corrupt with the Bush regime and we see what's happening, but if only we could go back to the good old days when we really had democracy. What are we talking about? When George Washington was a slave owner with 300 slaves?
That's right. Yeah.
When Thomas Jefferson was raping his enslaved Sally Hemings,
That's right. Yeah.
You know, as his concubine?
That's right.
when Andrew Jackson was slaughtering the indigenous people and stripping their skin off after he killed them to make leather strips to show, this is when we had democracy?
Yeah.
When we had democracy in this country, when general white people were lynching the African population for over 100 years, which wasn't something just, you might think that was just something that was, occasionally happened in the South. No, it happened in the North.
That's right.
It happened in New York.
That's right.
Did you know that New York City wanted to secede and join the South? It was so tied that there were, at certain times, at long periods, 1 in 5 people who lived in New York City were enslaved Africans, and that the economy of New York was so tied to the cotton industry that New York did not want to support the North during the Civil War. It wanted to secede and join the South.
That's right.
So, it's not like the North was this liberal thing. When white workers in New York were told that they had to fight on the side of the North, that's when those draft riots were in the Civil War, and they went out and killed and lynched Africans.
Right.
I mean, why do we think that we find in New York City this graveyard of African people under Wall Street? To me, that is a perfect analogy for what the United States is.
Right.
It is the wealth of imperialism resting on the backs of African people.
That's right.
And it happened here. And it happened everywhere. And the lynchings happened in Philadelphia, they happened in Boston, they happened in Chicago, just as much as they happened in Mississippi and Georgia and Florida and all of that. And I'm saying this because it's not just like, well, white workers were duped or, all these kind of things that we're told. But the reality is it was an expression of the understanding of white working people that their interest could be found in maintaining the oppression of African people.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, it is deep. It is so deep in this country. I have been able to do a little bit of research about what we have done and what we do now.
That's right.
And there's so much to tell. You know, lynchings weren't just, a posse at night. No, it was a big fair. It was a social gathering of sometimes 10,000 people. You might have seen those pictures. White people dressed up their little girls in starched pinafores to pose them in front of the bodies of African men hanging from trees to make postcards to send to their friends and souvenirs. You know, they cut off the hands, the ears, the sexual organs, the toes, the feet, and sold them.
That's right.
Those things are still here.
That's right.
And this is America. There's not a time when African people in this country had democracy or were citizens.
That's right.
Never.
That's right.
They didn't get the vote until 1965.
Right.
And for a minute, maybe they had the vote, but Bush proved that they didn't have the vote in 2000 anyway, and ever since then. So what we're talking about is there's two Americas. There's two Americas, and there's two worlds. There's Europe and North America, white people, and there's African people, indigenous people, Asian people, who are colonies that make up a pedestal on which we sit. And that makes so much sense. There's no way that you can really look at reality and say that that's not true. So that is the context that we're talking about in terms of the diamonds. When we talk about the diamond industry, we are talking about colonialism. In 1885, European powers met in Berlin, Germany. They had the Berlin Conference, in which, without one single African person present, they began to shift from the system of slavery to the system of direct colonialism. In that conference, they sat around a table for several days and divided up all of Africa without any Africans being there, so that, Ivory Coast was given to Britain or given to France, and Sudan was given to England, and South Africa was given to England, and Namibia was given to Germany, and, it was just parceled out. So, and the borders separated peoples who had lived together for thousands of years. There were false borders that were for only one purpose, to facilitate the colonial extraction. That's why they say in Africa, the trains, the railroad lines only run towards the coast. Everything goes out. This is the conditions that the diamonds are in. The diamonds are a colonial legacy. They have a colonial legacy in Africa. The diamonds industry, De Beers, which leads the worldwide diamond cartel, controls the entire market of diamonds all over the world, was founded by Cecil Rhodes, the brutal, genocidal British agent for British imperialism in Africa. You might have seen that famous cartoon of Cecil Rhodes with one foot on North Africa and one foot on South Africa. And the British always said they had an empire on which the sun never set. It went around the world. That's what created the wealth of Europe, of Britain. Yeah. It's all blood. It's all soaked in the blood of the peoples on the planet Earth. And that's what has to be exposed. Cecil Rhodes found the first diamond mine that he stole in Kimberley, South Africa. That's what we hear about this Kimberley process. It was in Kimberley, South Africa. It was the land of the Zulu, the Shona, the Ashanti, the different peoples who fought fiercely for their land. He brought in, for the first time, Maxim machine guns. And in one afternoon alone, and the people in Africa fought back fiercely, and for many years, and I'm talking about hundreds of years, against colonialism and slavery, the resistance was fierce. But Cecil Rhodes brought in the machine gun in the 1890s, and in one afternoon alone killed 5,000 Shona people who were resisting for their own land. He did that with a mercenary army from Europe, from Britain, from England. And what he did to pay them was give them each 6,000 acres in what is now Zimbabwe. So when we talk about the struggle that's going on in Zimbabwe right now, where the people want the land, well, yeah, they want the land because the white people still own the, quote, control the land, even though the land belongs to African people,
right.
Based on the fact that they committed genocide to African people in Africa. So, you know, there's no clean beginnings to this. This is it. And when they, so in order to, you know, build the diamond industry, they had to have near slave labor of African people in Africa. They, in the De Beers mines, they forced African people at gunpoint to work on their knees all day long, because at that time the diamonds were alluvial, which means you could just pick them up off the ground. And they had a can around their neck, and they had to just pick them up and put them in a can on their knees all day long. Not 8 hours, you know, 20 hours, whatever it was. They lived in work camps. This is actually a lot still true today. They were separated from their families. They were given a little cup of rice, which is still the conditions in Sierra Leone today for diamond miners. So, you know, the reality is the diamonds, like the oil, the bauxite, the gold, and all the other resources in Africa, including the animals and the beautiful landscape and everything else, belong to African people. It's just like in this country, in this hemisphere, this land belongs to the indigenous people.
That's right.
We participated in the genocide against it, and regular white people
did it.
All, you know, housewives, grandmothers, all did it.
Yes.
Picked up the gun. It's glorified now, isn't it, when it's called the pioneers. Mm-hmm. The pioneers were the civilian army who went out and slaughtered at Sand Creek, at Wounded Knee. Those were volunteers.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, and this is really important for us to understand, because it wasn't like the United States government was putting out a memo saying, you know, lynch Africans and kill indigenous. That we did it. We did it because we recognized that we could steal steal the land, and then we could keep our jobs, and African people wouldn't be getting it, and this was the condition. So this is the reality in Africa, that the diamonds are part of the colonial legacy. And I just want to say, and most people here might know, if you've read anything about diamonds, you know that they are not inherently valuable.
Right.
That the value was created. That diamonds occur anywhere in the world that there's carbon. And there's carbon everywhere. So what De Beers has done by controlling the market is creating a false scarcity. They will not let people sell outside of the process that they have established. This is why they have enormous warehouses and storage places of just incredible amounts of diamonds. But they maintain the scarcity. If you have a diamond, you should contribute it to this movement, because believe me, if you ever want to get rid of it, you can't sell it. It's not worth that much money. Because the value goes down on it. Because it has no value. It has no value in and of itself. It was created by De Beers, and it's maintained by De Beers. This is why De Beers was totally freaked out when the forces in Sierra Leone in the 1990s were selling diamonds outside of the De Beers controlled process. And that's what they called blood diamonds. They didn't care that these forces, who were neocolonialists, they were carrying out the will of Western powers and corporations, the RUF in Sierra Leone. They were brutal to the people. But De Beers didn't care about that.
Right.
De Beers had done the same thing, and it's done the same thing
for the last 100 years.
Right. The conditions of diamond workers and the people themselves all throughout Western and Southern Africa are brutal. You can't live on it. You know, children die 28%, even De Beers puts this out themselves. 28% of the children of the people of Sierra Leone, including diamond workers who work full time, die before they're 5 years old of curable disease and starvation and malnutrition. So this is the reality of today. And the fact is that De Beers was concerned about the question of blood diamonds only because it was being raised by people as a contradiction, but mostly because it would deflate their artificial scarcity and artificial value that they had assigned to diamonds. So this is the issue, and they started this thing called the Kimberley Process. Well, the fact is that the wars, those kind of wars that went on in the 1990s, are over for the moment, but the conditions of African people in Sierra Leone, in the legitimate mines, in Liberia, in Guinea-Conakry, where right at this moment they had raised the price of rice in Guinea-Conakry, and there's been a massive general strike for the past 2 weeks because people can't afford to buy the rice now. They are starving to death, and they're calling for the neocolonial president, Conte, to step down. And actually, the Uhuru movement has the relationship with organizations that are coordinating that and are thick up into that. I just want to say that today, a diamond worker at best in Sierra Leone makes 30 cents a day. There was actually, somebody was here today, we had a demonstration earlier in front of the Hilton where the diamond cartel was having its conference, and there was a taxi stand, and there was an African man from Sierra Leone, and he was kind of listening to what we were saying, and he was saying, we don't make 30 cents a day. We're lucky if we get a cup of rice to eat. We don't make 30 cents a day. You know, I mean, so 30 cents a day, you know, when you know those statistics that you read, like 50% of sub-Saharan Africa lives on less than a dollar a day or less than $2 a day, and you think, well, that's because things cost less there or something. No, people are starving.
Yeah.
They have no electricity, no clean water. They have no schools, no roads, nothing, nothing. People are just on day-to-day subsistence. And these are the conditions. That is violence. That is you know, the colonial violence against the people, and that's why we say that all diamonds are blood diamonds.
Right.
These are the conditions forced on them. De Beers and the diamond industry makes billions, hundreds of billions of dollars because they control every aspect of the diamond. They control the digging of the rough diamonds, they control the polishing, the cutting, the setting into jewelry, and all of the money, the profit and the wealth of that is in America, it's in Belgium, it's throughout Europe, it's in Israel, and it's in the white population, the settler population of South Africa today.
Right.
It is not anywhere where there's African people.
That's
right. African people are starving, and these, you know, this is how it is. So I just want to say that what we understand that our role, you know, in relationship to the peoples of the world, that when we see this crisis, when we see the struggle that's happening around, when we see what the Iraqi people are saying, the Venezuelan people are saying, when we see in Palestine, they're saying the land is theirs, the resources is theirs, and that there's nothing that De Beers or the diamond industry can do to remedy the situation except get out.
That's right.
Because the diamonds belong to Africa.
That's right.
The land belongs to Africa. If you think about it, Sierra Leone, West Africa, Azania, which is South Africa, Zimbabwe, Namibia, African people should be the most prosperous on the planet.
That's right, yeah,
because
that's right.
Africa is the richest in natural resources in the entire world. And every child should grow up with a beautiful house, a car, an excellent education, the ability to travel around the world, all the electronics and everything else that they need. They want to live. But we have it.
Right.
We have it.
Right.
And this is the relationship that we have to the peoples of the planet Earth. And this is why there's struggle everywhere, because people now, it's a small world. And they see, they can, you know, even when there's not electricity, there's the ability somehow to go to an internet cafe. They have computers, they see the films, they see, oh, there's our resources, America has it.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, and that's they it. Want yeah. their resources that's back, it. They're going to yes. feed their children.
Yes.
So there's no way that we can think that there's gonna be peace on this planet. If we, you know, our children and our children's children are just going to grow up in times of war, insecurity, you know, just having to live behind security bars and what kind of life is that?
Yeah.
To really realize that we live, you know, that our lives comes at the expense of everybody else, and we think that there's going to be peace on Earth, and that the U.S. would have enough guns and military to try to, you know, control the entire planet. It's not going to happen. And what this movement is about is saying that we have the ability to join that, to say that this system is foul.
That's right.
And that the right of the peoples on the planet Earth to control their land and resources is just, it is the only way that there can be a world in which all people can live in. It is the contradiction that we face. And that when we think about the struggle for Africa, it means, you know, just the Black Power movement here. It means the struggle of African people. The slogan of the African Socialist International led by the Uhuru movement is touch one, touch all. A struggle in Haiti can't happen in isolation anymore.
Right.
A struggle in Guinea-Conakry can't happen in
That's
isolation
right.
anymore.
That's right.
That African people are uniting. And if we think about this, if Africa had its resources, if it had its diamonds, if African people benefited from that, the police in New York City would not be able to shoot down Sean Bell
right.
on the streets of Queens. They would not be able to kill Amadou Diallo.
Yes.
They would not be able to put 35% of young African men into prison for things our kids don't even get arrested
That's
for.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They would not be able to force this gentrification that further displaces and impoverishes the African community. They would not be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about something that is an inevitable wave of the future, and I believe that it is in truly in our interest to join on the side of the peoples on the planet Earth, to see that the future, all that's in the news right now is about the environment and the serious condition that's there. But what this system has done to the environment is simply a symptom of what it has done to the people on this planet.
Yes.
The genocide that it has committed. There's no way to patch up the ozone level or save the whales when there's genocide going on against African and indigenous people. How could that happen? But in fact, what will happen is that when the peoples on the planet Earth, when their spirit, their far-sightedness, their ability to solve problems is unleashed, that's how these problems are going to be taken on. The system that created it is not going to solve it. It has no idea how to do that. So I feel that we have an interest in joining in solidarity with the struggle of African people for the ability for them to control all of Africa's resources and Africa itself, and for the peoples on the planet Earth to have their land, their resources, without the intervention of this system built on slavery and genocide. Uhuru.
Uhuru, that was Penny Hess of the African People's Solidarity Committee. This concludes our broadcast of uhururadio.com. Tune in again next Sunday to uhururadio.com, online voice of the International African Revolution. This has been a program, White Solidarity with Black Power. We will be with you again next Sunday. Uhuru.
We live in a world that is constructed of the theft of the resources, both material and human, of African and other people as a consequence of its existence. Stealing black labor, black bodies, black territory, of the rape of Asia, Latin America, etc. It's a rotten, foul social system. That's the world we live in. And if you raise the question of reparations, it makes it necessary for African people to come to terms with this. So much is done against us all the time. Demoralizing black people. You took my money, you took my resources, you stole every damn thing we got. I want it back.
Gonna be off the chain, you ain't gotta wonder why.
We don't need no